Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, after years of allowing censorship and criminal prosecution of dissent, what caused the radical turnaround by the Supreme Court to then support free speech and dissent? Then, we know that the wealthy have more influence than other Americans. But just how unrepresentative is the American Congress and the state legislatures? For decades in American history, the government censored and prosecuted critics and dissenters, and the Supreme Court upheld those acts. But something changed around the end of World War I that caused a radical shift in the law, which brought the country into a free speech era. Our next guest tracks the beginnings of this change in his new book, The Great Dissent: How Oliver Wendell Holmes Changed His Mind and Changed the History of Free Speech in America. Thomas Healy joins us now. He's a professor of law at Seton Hall Law School and the author of The Great Dissent. Welcome, Thomas Healy.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you here on the Scholar Circle. Let's start with your premise in this book, which is that this one justice changed his mind after some lobbying, and it really set the stage for changing the body of law with regards to free speech, the legal regime, as we call it.
Well, you're right. The book is about the personal transformation of one justice, but that personal transformation marks the beginning of a larger national transformation on the issue of free speech. Most people now take for granted in this country that we have extraordinary protection to say what we want, to criticize the government. And in fact, that's true. We have greater free speech rights in the United States than almost anywhere else in the world. But it wasn't always that way. Prior to the early 20th century, the First Amendment in this country was largely an unfulfilled promise. The Supreme Court had never upheld a free speech claim prior to the early 20th century, and lower courts had approved all manner of speech restrictions, from the censorship of books and films to the prohibition of street corner speeches, to bans on labor protests and commercial advertising. And so really for about the first 130 or 140 years of our country's history, the First Amendment and free speech was an empty slogan. And so this decision, this dissenting opinion that Holmes writes in 1919, it really turns the tide. It marks the beginning of our appreciation for the value of free speech, and it eventually ushers in the modern era of the First Amendment, under which speech is protected unless it poses an imminent danger.
And so there were prosecutions for people who dissented against the government in a few cases. People were going to jail for this.
They certainly were. You know, we had the first sort of brush with this kind of persecution shortly after the founding of the country in 1798. The Sedition Act was passed, which essentially made it a crime to criticize the government. And a couple of dozen people were prosecuted under that law and sent to jail. Now, there was a political backlash at that time, and Thomas Jefferson was elected president in 1800, and the Sedition Act of 1798 expired, and Jefferson pardoned those who had been convicted under it. But that sort of set the stage for this notion that you could be punished in this country for criticizing the government. Now, for the next 100 or so years, free speech was a sort of a fringe issue. It would flare up every once in a while. There was the Comstock Act, which was passed in the 1870s, which was targeted at the mailing of obscene materials, but ended up being applied against, anatomy textbooks or material about contraception or even the plays of George Bernard Shaw. There were disputes about labor unions and their ability to protest on the street. And then during World War I, the federal government passed the Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917 and 1918, which really made it very difficult to say almost anything critical of the war, of the draft, of the president's handling of the war. These laws really cast a shadow over public discussion about these matters. Nearly 2,000 indictments were brought under these two laws, and many people were sent to jail for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, often for incredibly innocuous kinds of statements. If you said that you thought the draft was unconstitutional, you could be punished under these laws. Or if you thought that the war was being fought to line the pockets of capitalists. Someone was even prosecuted for showing the film Birth of a Nation, which was about the Revolutionary War. But the problem was that that film showed British soldiers killing American civilians and therefore was thought to undermine support for our ally, England, during World War I. And so people were incredibly at risk. And, you know, not all the people who were prosecuted were, you know, sort of fringe, unknown people. Eugene Debs, who was the leader of the Socialist Party in the United States, he was prosecuted for a campaign speech he gave in Canton, Ohio. Eugene Debs had run for president. He eventually ran five times. At this point, he had run four times, but he had received 6% of the popular vote in 1912, I believe it was, which is a large percentage of the popular vote for a third-party candidate. I don't believe that any third-party candidate since then has achieved that level of success. And, you know, so this would be like if during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, if, you know, Bush administration had prosecuted Ron Paul for his criticism of the government's actions and put Ron Paul in jail for 10 years, that would be an analogous situation. And so, yes, people were, you know, they were punished quite severely for their views. And during World War I, the mainstream intellectuals and thinkers began to realize what a problem this was.
And so your primary subject of study here is one justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes. He's a name that most people have heard of, but a lot of people don't know what his contribution has been. Now, he was even somebody supportive of repressing certain kinds of speech under the law, and he upheld convictions prior to this turnaround that you documented so well in your book, The Great Dissent. How would you characterize him before the turnaround?
Well, you're absolutely right that Holmes himself had never been a staunch defender of free speech. In fact, I think it's fair to say that prior to this dissenting opinion that he writes in 1919, he had done as much as any American judge to render the First Amendment toothless. Holmes was, he was born in 1841, and he was the son of Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who was a famous doctor and author. He helped to found the Atlantic Monthly magazine. He coined the term Boston Brahmin, and he was part of a kind of intellectual aristocracy in New England, and that was the world that Holmes was born into. He went to Harvard College. He fought in the Civil War for the Union side. He was wounded three times during the war, twice severely, and after the war, he went to Harvard Law School, practiced for a while, became a judge on the Massachusetts Supreme Court, and then was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1902. And Holmes's main contribution as a thinker, as a legal thinker, prior to this dissenting opinion in 1919, was to advance the idea of judicial restraint. We hear a lot these days about judicial activism and judicial restraint. Holmes was one of the first vocal advocates of the idea of judicial restraint, which means that judges should defer to what a majority of the people decide to do through their elected officials. And at the time, this was actually the position of judicial restraint was something that was actually being advocated by progressives. These days, it's often reversed. You often have conservatives advocating judicial restraint, and liberals are often sort of stereotyped as being in favor of judicial activism. But the roles were reversed at this point in our history, and the reason they were reversed is because the courts at this time, conservative courts, were often striking down progressive labor laws. And Holmes had objected to that. Not because he favored these progressive labor laws. He really had very little sympathy for the common man. But instead, he simply thought that the majority should be able to do what it wanted, that law should reflect the majority's will, and that judges should not stand in the way. And so he had written a very important dissenting opinion in a 1905 case in which he articulated this view, and progressives cheered this opinion that he had written. But Holmes not only was willing to defer to the majority when the majority was, you know, advancing progressive labor legislation, he was willing to defer to the majority even when the majority was being insensitive to rights that progressives cared about, such as the right to free speech. And so he had written a number of opinions in which he had basically dismissed the right of free speech. He had embraced a very restrictive view of free speech that came out of English common law, which only prohibited the government from imposing what is known as a prior restraint, sort of censorship before the fact, but allowed the government to impose any kind of punishment it wanted to on speech after the fact. He had upheld prosecutions of an anarchist editor for inciting nude sunbathing, a policeman who was fired for talking politics had challenged his dismissal, and Holmes said that the policeman might have a right to talk politics, but he had no right to be a policeman. So Holmes had never demonstrated, prior to this dissenting opinion in 1919, any sympathy for the right of free speech, which makes this dissenting opinion that he writes so surprising and so interesting.
From your book, The Great Dissent, I lifted some quotes just to give people a sense of what he was like before. So first, as you said, he wasn't a subscriber to any individual rights, but he had written in one case, "If my fellow citizens want to go to hell, I will help them."
That's my job.
And then he called workers in one case thick-fingered clowns and said every society rests on the death of men. So he wasn't exactly sympathetic to people's plights, and he wasn't sympathetic to individuals' rights.
Not at all. And a lot of this was a result of his experience during the war. You know, when he says every society rests on the death of men, well, he's saying that because he's seen it. He's seen soldiers marched off to war at the point of a bayonet. And his view is that, you know, sometimes society has to sacrifice individuals in order to achieve its objectives. And if we do that in a time of war, you know, if we're willing to march soldiers off to war at the point of a bayonet, if we're willing to force people to get vaccinated against their will because we don't want disease to spread, well, then why wouldn't we tell people they can't say certain things that we think are going to harm us? He said to one of his friends during this time period who was trying to persuade him to adopt a more expansive view of free speech and was arguing in favor of tolerance, Holmes responded that the individual was striking at the sacred right to kill the other fellow when he disagrees. Well, that's what war is. And Holmes had seen it firsthand.
Right.
You know, that's what you do. The North and the South went to war and they killed each other because of a disagreement. And he thought, look, if we're willing to do that, why shouldn't we be willing to put people in jail because they say something that we think is harmful?
Which makes it all the more profound, the transformation that he made that really set up the next legal regime protecting speech. A reminder that you're listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Thomas Healy about The Great Dissent, how Oliver Wendell Holmes changed his mind and changed the history of free speech in America. Let's backtrack a little bit into how this happened. You think the first real step towards him changing his mind was a train ride where he crossed paths with a state judge who was also a major legal thinker, Billings Learned Hand. Who was Learned Hand, and why does this particular encounter matter?
Learned Hand, first of all, has one of the best names of all time for an American judge. And it's spelled learned as in educated. He was very sensitive about his name. He thought it sounded pretentious or maybe that it made him even sound like he was, this is his word, that he was a sissy. Learned Hand was a very smart judge. He was on the federal district court in New York at the time, lived in New York City. He was a graduate of Harvard, a very philosophical judge. He had majored in philosophy at Harvard College, had attended Harvard Law School, and then had moved to New York City after a few years and became quite active in progressive circles and was ultimately appointed to the federal court in New York City. And Learned Hand had written an important judicial opinion in 1917 about the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act, which was passed shortly after we went to war, as I said, basically made it a crime to obstruct the draft or to incite disloyalty in the military, and it authorized the post office to deny mailing privileges to any publication that was deemed to be in violation. And so a case came before Learned Hand that was brought by a radical newspaper or magazine at the time called The Masses. The Masses had been blocked from circulating through the mail because of some poems and cartoons that were in its issues, and they challenged this and said that that this violated the First Amendment. And Learned Hand, he narrowly interpreted the law, the Espionage Act, to only apply to explicit incitement to violate the law. He said that the law wasn't meant to punish, you know, mere discussion of public affairs or criticism of the government, but that you could only be punished under the Espionage Act if you explicitly advocated unlawful conduct. And this was a very bold and courageous decision for Hand to reach. He was the first federal judge in the country to interpret the Espionage Act, but unfortunately, he was soon reversed by the Federal Appeals Court. And Hand was incredibly discouraged by this. He didn't like what he saw going on in the country, and so when he ran into Holmes on a train between New York and Boston, less than a year later, they knew each other a little bit prior to this point. They ran into each other on a train, and so Hand strikes up this conversation with Holmes and is talking to Holmes about tolerance. And this is when Holmes responds that Hand strikes at the sacred right to kill the other fellow when he disagrees. And Hand, who was an anxious and generally insecure person and really worshipped Holmes, Holmes was fairly old at this point. He's 78 years old and a sort of venerable figure. Hand is sort of shocked into silence and doesn't know what to say. And then Holmes gets off the train and Hand is thinking about this, and he writes Holmes a letter a couple of days later, and we have this letter and Holmes' response. And they begin this correspondence about tolerance and the importance of tolerance. And the argument that Hand makes to Holmes is not one about inalienable rights. Instead, it's a pragmatic argument, and it goes something like this, that we can never be sure we're right. We've been wrong about many things in the past, and we'll be wrong about many things in the future. And since we can never be sure we're right, we have to allow for the possibility that people we disagree with might actually be right and we might be wrong. And if we suppress their views, then we're going to lose the benefits of their wisdom. And so the reason to be tolerant is not to respect individual rights, but simply because there's a chance that the other person might be right and we're wrong, and we're going to hurt ourselves, and we're going to, you know, hurt the public welfare if we cut off their speech. And this is the kind of argument that Holmes would be responsive to, a pragmatic argument, and he writes back and indicates that he's in general agreement, but it's clear that he hasn't really embraced the view, that he still thinks that, you know, if something's important enough to you, you will do what you think you need to do, even if you think you might be wrong. That we have to act, even in the face of uncertainty. And so even if we think we're wrong, we might still force people to get vaccinations, we might still force people to go to war, or we might still suppress their speech. But in any case, this begins, this encounter between Holmes and Hand and this correspondence, it begins what is really a kind of year-and-a-half-long lobbying campaign by Hand and a broader group of young progressive intellectuals who are friends with Holmes and who look up to Holmes and who are trying to get Holmes to adopt a more expansive view of free speech.
One of these other people that was influential was Harold Laski. Who was Harold Laski?
Not many people today know about Harold Laski. You know, fewer people know who Harold Laski is, I think, than Learned Hand. But there was a time in history when everybody knew who Harold Laski was. At this time in our history, Harold Laski was 24 years old. He was an immigrant from England, a Jewish immigrant from England, and he was an instructor in economics and political theory at Harvard. And he was a contributor to the New Republic. He had this incredibly large personality, very irrepressible, very brilliant, very prolific. By the time he was 24, he had written two books. He wrote tons of articles. He could read a couple of hundred pages an hour, and he made a very large impression on the sort of intellectual circles in Washington and New England when he arrived. He ultimately moved back to England and became the most prominent socialist of the mid-20th century, and he was the leader of the Labour Party in England during the latter years of World War II. And so he ended up becoming an incredibly influential global figure. He, unlikely as it is, he became incredibly close friends with Holmes. And you have to think about just how strange this is. Holmes is 78 years old. He is a justice on the Supreme Court. He is a Boston Brahmin. He is a Republican at this time. He doesn't really care about politics. Laski, on the other hand, he's 24. He's Jewish. He doesn't come from a particularly prominent family. His father made some money, but prior to that, his family was not prominent. He is incredibly liberal. I describe him in the book as being just to the right of Marx. In his earlier years, he had even engaged in a little bit of terrorism. He had planted a bomb in a railway station in England. He was a militant suffragist and was incredibly political.
And wasn't he also a character that Ayn Rand based her villain on?
He was. He was the model for Ellsworth Toohey, who is the socialist villain in The Fountainhead, which is really amusing. I had read The Fountainhead years ago, and when I was doing the research for this book, and I came across that fact and went back and read the description of Toohey. It was very interesting. She based that description of Toohey on Laski, and yet he and Holmes, in spite of all these differences, they became incredibly close friends. They were introduced to each other by another young, sort of rising intellectual, Felix Frankfurter, who went on to become a justice on the Supreme Court in the 1940s and 50s and even 60s. At this time, he is a young law professor at Harvard who occasionally comes down to Washington to work in various Democratic administrations. And he met Holmes in the early 19-teens and introduced Holmes to Laski and a bunch of other men who revolved around this house in Washington, D.C., that was known as the House of Truth. It was a sort of literary legal salon in DuPont Circle that was a gathering spot for young lawyers and journalists and diplomats. And Frankfurter introduced Holmes to this circle of men and introduced Holmes to Laski. And Holmes is at a point in his life where he's looking for the recognition that he thinks that he's owed. And he hasn't quite gotten it yet, but these young men want to give it to him. And so he's quite susceptible to their influence. And they, of course, are thrilled that this justice of the Supreme Court is paying attention to them and taking seriously their ideas. A lot of these young men, they become almost like surrogate sons for Holmes, who had no children of his own. And Lasky and Frankfurter in particular, Holmes really had a kind of paternal relationship with. And so, they become very close during the years 1917, 1918, 1919. And Frankfurter and Lasky join this campaign, join hand in this sort of unspoken, unorganized, behind-the-scenes lobbying campaign to convince Holmes of the value of free speech.
We will continue next week with Thomas Healy about The Great Dissent, how Oliver Wendell Holmes changed his mind and changed the history of free speech in America next week, so stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Whose interests and policy preferences are represented in the halls of Congress and the state legislatures? And how much has changed over the years? What impacts this? Our next guests have measured this relationship in their research. Three experts join us. Martin Gillens is professor of politics at Princeton University and the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. Thomas Hayes also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Connecticut. His publications include Responsiveness in an Era of Inequality, The Case of the U.S. Senate. Patrick Flavin joins us. He is a professor of political science at Baylor University, and his publications include Income Inequality and Policy Representation in the American States. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. All three of you have found generally that the interests of the wealthy are better represented than others in our legislatures. There have been some dramatic words used: plutocracy, gilded age, oligarchic, powerful words. Is it really this dramatic, Martin Gillens?
I'm afraid it is. When I started this project, I expected to find, as I think anyone would, that affluent Americans have more influence over government policy than those who are less well off. But what I didn't expect to find was the really shocking degree to which that's true. And I looked at data over about four decades and found that under most circumstances, what poor people or the middle class prefer as far as government policy goes seems to bear virtually no relationship to what the government actually does.
You did look across policies, and there were some differences depending on which policies you were looking at.
Well, generally speaking, the patterns of inequality that I found seemed to hold in varying degrees across the entire sort of gamut of federal policymaking. So it wasn't just economic policies or policies with sort of strongly redistributive components, but, you know, even things, certain aspects of foreign policy or social issues having to do with things like abortion and so on, these kinds of issues also seem to reflect predominantly the influence of the affluent. Now, of course, there are issues on which there's little disagreement across income levels, right? On issues, for example, certain defense issues, aspects of the environment and so on, where poor people, the middle class, and the well-off tend to agree. Well, on those issues, of course, people at the bottom of the income distribution are just as likely to see their preferences adopted as those at the top, right, by definition. But when the preferences do diverge, then only under very special sort of political circumstances do we really see any substantial influence from the poor or by the poor or the middle class.
Now, before we bring in the other scholars to compare their findings with yours, two other aspects of your book that were really quite interesting. One is that there wasn't very much difference across the parties unless we had strong competition, which we don't usually have in this country. You would expect the Democrats to be more responsive to middle class and poor people. Why this steady sense of who is represented?
Well, I think you're right. That was another surprise in this work, that we did not see policies more reflective of a sort of a broader range of the public or the less well-off, you know, groups among Americans when Democrats were in power, as I would have expected. And I think there's a few reasons. One of them is that both parties over the past few decades have adopted a set of sort of market-oriented policies that are much more popular among the well-off than among the middle class or the poor. And this includes like the sort of deregulatory move in federal policymaking that arguably started with Carter and accelerated under Reagan, but was embraced by Clinton as well. You know, things like, of course, the deregulation of the financial sector, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, more broadly, a move toward a deregulatory environment. Also with trade policy, we see the same thing, a sort of steady move over the last few decades in a direction of a freer trade regime, which is more popular and arguably more beneficial to people at the top of the income distribution. So I think that's one reason, is that the parties are less different than they used to be on a set of important policies where the interests and preferences of Americans differ. And the other reason is that while it's generally true that on other dimensions of economic policy, like tax policy and the minimum wage, the Democrats are more representative of and more aligned with what the middle class and the poor prefer, yet there's a different set of policies, which are these sort of social, moral, religious kinds of policies, where it's actually Republicans who are more consistent with the typically more conservative views of low-income Americans. So things like abortion, school prayer, gay rights, on these kinds of issues, we actually see a different party alignment with regard to economic distribution of preferences.
Those tend to be the more emotional issues. And I think scholars are finding more and more that there are a lot of people that are emotional voters as opposed to rational voters.
Yeah, there's a hot debate about that in political science.
Tom Hayes, let's bring you in. How does this comport with your research? You've looked at the Senate, but you've also looked at how people actually understand these policies.
Sure. So my research is really in line with what Martin's finding. I looked at senator responsiveness to their constituents over about a 10-year period from 2000 to 2010. And generally, my findings were very similar in that senators consistently responded to upper-income constituents, not able to detect any responsiveness to low-income constituents. And this was really consistent no matter which party controlled the Senate or not.
Did you divide the policies up that you looked at as well in the way that Martin Gillens did?
No. My policy, the way that it looks at it, is all votes cast by senators to determine their ideology, their relationship with one another, and how well that matches up with constituency opinion, again, ideologically. And again, there's very consistent results, and that in no instance, really any way that I cut the data and ran the results, was I able to find responsiveness to low-income poor Americans.
Tom, also there was another aspect that I was trying to understand, something that you said about how citizens are not always able to understand the issues as thoroughly. If they truly understood the consequences of the issues, they might respond differently in terms of their preference. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. So there's been decades of research in political science that shows that there's relatively low levels of knowledge among all Americans in terms of political knowledge. And this has been kind of consistent throughout time, that people have really little interests and little knowledge of political affairs. I looked at the relationship between people's views on inequality as well as their views on government spending on different programs like education, retirement, and healthcare. So I looked at to what degree do those match up. And what I found is that there is a correlation, there is a relationship. It's just not a very strong relationship between the two. So that is to say that there is a relationship between people that want the government to spend more on things like healthcare or education. That relationship matches up with their views on inequality. They want the government to do something to reduce inequality. But it's a very weak relationship, and it's not a relationship that is strong enough perhaps to propel elected officials to act to reduce this growing inequality that we've seen.
And Pat Flavin, let's bring you in now. You've looked at this specifically in the state legislatures, found something kind of similar. How different do the states respond to their constituencies than the Congress?
So thanks for having us. So I found the results very similar to what Tom and Martin found at the national level, and that is at the state level, we find the same thing, that upper-income constituents are much more likely to see their policy opinions reflected in the policy choices that state legislatures make. And that was true for both the general liberalism of policies, so asking citizens whether they're conservative or liberal, then looking at the kind of general tone of state policies. And it was also true for specific policies, so kind of similar to what Martin did. I looked at the death penalty and opinions on abortion. And for those as well, upper-income constituents, their opinions were well reflected in state policies, but for low-income constituents, you don't see any relationship. So consistent findings with what the other two gentlemen have found, just looking at a different level of government. So it seems like political inequality, regardless of the level of government that's under consideration, that there's political inequality wherever we look.
Did you divide up the states to see if some were more representative than others?
Well, I think that's the next step in this research area. I think us three and other scholars have pretty well documented that the poor are poorly represented. So I think the next question is, under what conditions are they better represented, or is there more equal representation? So Martin had mentioned that he's looked at the equality of representation under more competitive versus less competitive conditions. I've started to look at institutional fixes or possible fixes. So, for example, if states with more stringent campaign finance laws have more equal representation, if direct democracy, the ballot initiative process, if that can promote greater equality. So I think that's the next step, is to look at, well, why are some states more equal than others? What do they have that the other states don't?
And then maybe even an international comparison. Why do some countries have better representation than others?
Right. If I can jump in here on this question, Martin Gillens here. You know, I think Patrick's exactly right. Looking at these sorts of institutional factors is the next step in this kind of research. But one thing that I was able to look at just at the national level was the role of impending elections. And that was one ray of hope in the findings in my project, in as much as during periods of especially presidential elections, the periods leading up to presidential elections, we do see a greater consistency between government policies and the preferences of the public, and a somewhat more equal responsiveness to people in the middle or at the bottom of the economic spectrum. So there's never really a period where the middle class has as much influence as the affluent, or the poor as much as the middle class, but nevertheless, you do see some responsiveness to those less well-off groups in presidential election years that you don't see in other years of the electoral cycle.
One of the other things that I gathered from your book is that this has been getting progressively worse. Would you say that's the case?
Well, you know, when I started this work, I had expected to find that during the 1960s, which is the earliest period that I collected data for, that there would have been a golden age, or at least a more equal responsiveness to the preferences of the middle class and the poor under those conditions. So I looked at the Johnson administration, a period of very strong democratic control. Unions, of course, were stronger in those days. Inequality, economic inequality was less. And so I was expecting to find a strong responsiveness during that period, or at least a stronger responsiveness to a broader spectrum of the public, and then thinking maybe that has declined over time. But in fact, I never found that. there never was a period that showed any kind of consistent responsiveness to the less well-off. However, it does appear from my data that responsiveness to the affluent has grown over time.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Martin Gillens, Pat Flavin, and Tom Hayes about just how much influence the affluent have on the American lawmaking process. So who were they responsive to in the past if they weren't being responsive necessarily to the poor? Maybe is it just that the middle class had more say?
No, that doesn't appear to be the case, at least during the Johnson years. So I think there was a lesson that I took away from the analysis of that period, which is that when there's dominant party control, that you don't really get responsiveness to the public at all. That what you get is parties adopting their own priorities and responding to their own sort of core constituencies, their own interest groups and funders and so on. And that's what we saw during the Johnson years in the mid-1960s, where some of the policies were, in fact, strongly supported by the less well-off. You know, the Great Society, of course, you know, comes to mind as a prominent policymaking during those years. But other policies were not, and things like the loosening of immigration laws in the 1960s were very unpopular with the public and extremely unpopular with lower-income Americans. And yet that was a Democratic Party priority that they were able to enact because of the very strong control that they have of the government. So I think that there may have been other periods that I didn't look at, but at least the data that I have didn't ever show any period of strong responsiveness to the middle class or the poor. But as I said, it did seem to show a gradually increasing responsiveness to the affluent.
Tom Hayes?
Sure. I think that I have something that is very similar. So I looked at the 107th Congress, which was right in 2001, and it's an interesting case because right in the middle of this congressional session, a Republican senator decides to switch parties. Senator Jim Jeffords, a Republican, switches to be an independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats. And so it allows us to look at a period in which Republicans control the Senate, the agenda, to one in which the Democrats, right in the middle of this congressional session, get to take over. And what I found is that when the Democrats took over, actually overall responsiveness to the wealthy increases. And also, in one of the congressional sessions that I looked at was the period in which the Senate was controlled by the Democrats, and this is right when Barack Obama becomes president. And again, even in that Congress, I find responsiveness very consistently to upper-income Americans.
One thing that, Martin Gillens, you started to talk about here, and you also talked about in your book, is the role of interest groups and how in some cases these interest groups do represent the interests of the very wealthy, but in some cases they're acting like a great equalizer in terms of who is represented.
Sure. I guess I'd say there's two ways that interest groups kind of work to benefit the interests or preferences of the less well-off. And one is that there are some groups who are sort of focused on issues that are beneficial to middle class or to low-income Americans. And those, of course, would include unions, which play sort of a broad role, although a much smaller role now than they did decades ago in influencing federal policy, but unions and perhaps even organizations like the AARP. But in addition to that, there are other groups, business groups, where at least on particular issues, their preferences, the kinds of policies that they are lobbying for, are actually more consistent with what low-income or middle-income Americans prefer. And the reason for that is that business interests in Washington tend to, on the one hand, advocate lower taxes, but on the other hand, advocate greater government spending on the issues that they care about. So we've got a massive healthcare industry, for example, that's pushing in Washington for greater government spending on healthcare. Well, that is a policy that works to the benefit and gets more support from the middle class and the poor than from the affluent. So in those kinds of cases, you do see, I think, a coincidence of interests or preferences between interest groups and less well-off Americans, despite the fact that those interest groups are not pursuing those policies because it helps the less well-off. they're pursuing them because it helps their particular industries.
And you did not look, as I recall from your book, at some of the interest groups that people might think of as more public interest groups, some of the environmental organizations, some of the public citizens of the world. You didn't look at their role at all in this.
That's correct. I just looked at 43 groups that were identified in surveys of sort of Washington insiders as the most powerful interest organizations in Washington.
Okay.
That did not include, it did include things like the AARP and unions and so on, but it did not include some of those smaller, more public interest-oriented groups.
And what's interesting about your work over time, too, is the fact that unions have lost power and lost membership, and yet the trend seems to continue as opposed to drastically change in one direction.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Pat Flavin, do you see any of this relationship also on the state level?
Yeah, I think the states, from a research perspective, the nice thing about it is that we have 50 of them, and so they vary sometimes pretty dramatically in how they approach politics, how they set up their laws and their institutions. And so where Martin looked at how things have ebbed and flowed over time, that's one way to kind of look at what factors cause more or less inequality. And another way is to look at, well, across the state, how do we see certain institutions lining up? So I had mentioned before campaign finance laws, there was concern at the national level about the Citizens United decision and how that might affect elections. It might be too early to tell, given that the decision isn't too far out. But at the state level, we can see all sorts of variation because some states have very strict limits. Some states have public financing systems. Some states have no limits. So we can look at, well, do those states where a single individual could bankroll a candidate, do we see more unequal representation there? And some research that I've done suggests, yes, that places where laws are very lax, there's basically very little control over campaign finance, that the poor are especially poorly represented in those particular states. I think the states also provide a great way to look at this problem and hopefully to come up with some possible recommendations or solutions on making things a little more equal.
You looked primarily, you said, at the social issues more than fiscal issues.
Right. And earlier research that I had done, when I broke it out by specific issues, I did look at social issues, which I think is interesting. I think it mirrors what Martin had said, that you see this interesting trend in public opinion where on economic issues, the rich are more conservative than the poor, as we might expect. But on social issues, gay marriage, abortion, etc., it's actually flipped, where the poor tend to be more conservative and wealthier folks tend to be more liberal. So you might expect, if policy was, say, uniformly trending conservatively, that the poor would win on some issues and not on others. But that's not what I find at the state level, and that's not what Martin finds at the national level either, that it's, whether it's economic issues or it's moral or social issues, the preferences of the poor don't get much representation. They don't seem to get reflected in what the decisions that policymakers make.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Martin Gillens, Pat Flavin, and Tom Hayes about just how much influence the affluent have on the American lawmaking process. Do you think now, looking at this, stepping back, that this is driven primarily by interest groups and campaign contributions, which come from interest groups and wealthy people? Or does it perhaps come from the fact that people who are in office tend to be wealthier? Or does it come from perhaps the fact that people are not very well informed and their preferences sometimes don't reflect what's necessarily better for them in their lives? Martin Gillens, you talked about this in your book. What's your take on this?
I guess I'd say that it does not result from a lack of information. It's true that people who have lower incomes on average are somewhat less informed about politics, but even people, you know, with at the top of the income distribution on average are not particularly knowledgeable about the details of public policy. And most of the cases where the poor are sort of viewed as not having sort of the real understanding of what their true interests are cases where they agree with affluent Americans when people think they really shouldn't. So things like support for the elimination of the inheritance tax or support for the Bush tax cuts are examples of this. But, of course, what we're finding in our work, all three of us, is that would suggest you'd see more responsiveness to the preferences of the poor than you actually do. So that, I don't think, is the reason. And I think interest groups are also not really the main factor here. And there's just too many cases where the interest group universe as a whole does not align with what affluent Americans want. And we talked about some of the examples earlier. And a third factor, which I think we can rule out, is the greater political participation of middle-class or affluent Americans, right? So sometimes when I present this work, people will say, well, yes, but poor people don't turn out to vote, so of course they have less influence. But it turns out that middle-class Americans vote and participate in politics in other ways at almost the same levels as those with high incomes. And yet the discrepancies in the amount of influence they have is vast. So I don't think that kind of participation really can explain it. So what does that leave? That leaves money. And, you know, the old adage about money being the mother's milk of politics, you know, I think this is just the expression of that in policymaking, that we see the people who are contributing the dollars to campaigns, to interest, parties and interest organizations, these are the people whose preferences, lo and behold, are reflected in policy outcomes.
And Tom Hayes?
I wholeheartedly agree that donations absolutely play a role. And something that I would add to that is that, you know, the working class are not really very well represented in the legislature. And there's work by Nicholas Carnes at Duke University that supports this idea that really throughout American history, we don't see members of the legislature coming from these working class backgrounds that they might be more likely to identify with and understand kind of the plight of the poor. I think it's important that in all of our research, what we're looking at is that legislators and public officials oftentimes have a choice in who they can respond to, whether it's the wealthy or the poor, because oftentimes those preferences diverge, not always, but often. And what we're consistently finding is that always this siding with the affluent.
Pat Flavin?
I agree, you know, with Tom and Martin. I think they hit on the two big ones, and that is lower class folks are just not well represented in government. Nicholas Carnes, the scholar that Tom mentioned, has a great book about that that shows that people from working class backgrounds are virtually non-existent in state legislatures and in Congress. You know, the Senate's often referred to as a millionaire's club. I think there's a lot of truth to that. So I think that's one possibility, is that there aren't working class or low-income folks in government to represent those interests. And then the second, I totally agree with Martin, it's the role of money in politics. And it seems that we're moving away from regulation or towards less regulation, and you know, my concern with that would be that that's going to lead to even more unequal representation, that if we wanted to equalize things or give everyone's opinion a fair shot, that we should be looking to try to lessen the influence of money. But right now it seems we're working in the opposite direction.
Given that where the Supreme Court has landed on campaign finance and equating it with free speech, a lot of scholars think that money should not be equated with speech. But where are the potential reforms if you want to have a truly representative government? Martin Gillens, what would you say?
Well, I think the current climate is quite challenging in that regard, as you suggested. You know, there is some room, and states have attempted to take advantage of that even within existing campaign finance laws for things like public financing that involve voluntary commitments to limits on expenditures, or in some cases even responses to third-party spending, such as we saw recently in Massachusetts. But it's not clear whether, you know, within the current legal framework, whether we can sort of come up with effective campaign regulations. You know, people talk about campaign regulation as being kind of like squeezing a balloon, where you squeeze one place and it comes out in another. So I think it is a huge challenge. Now, on the other hand, you know, the Citizens United decision was a 5-4 decision, and one might hope that some future Supreme Court that's, you know, more amenable to campaign finance, we might see some shift. But that's a slim read, I think, to hold our hopes on.
Tom Hayes?
Well, I agree that the current political climate would be very difficult to see a lot of these reforms that might change the system. Although, you know, I don't think that it's insurmountable or impossible. If we think about other periods of inequality in American history, whether it's income inequality or racial inequality, we see reaction by the public. And when the public does put a lot of pressure on elected officials for changes, oftentimes we can see these very entrenched institutions be changed and be more responsive to what the public wants. There's the progressive response to the First Gilded Age and other times in American history in which the government instituted reforms.
You bring up something that I meant to bring up earlier, which is the issue of race within this equation. Is that something that you have looked at in terms of the racial inequalities and representation? Pat Flavin?
Right, and I can give a quick summary of some findings that I've had on previous research for racial inequality, and there you see the same type of inequality that African-Americans and Hispanics, their preferences are less likely to be represented. Basically, if you think about groups that we traditionally think as disadvantaged in American politics, I think the work of all three of us has shown that those groups' opinions really aren't that well reflected. So we had that inclination, and I think our work has helped to show that. So I would just give a plug to this program and the work that we're doing and others that is finally really calling attention to this and calling attention to the fact that there's growing income inequality and growing political inequality. I think Tom's exactly right that for something to change or for remedies to happen, people have to know it's happening. And so I think that's some small role that we as scholars can play is calling attention to this, and that this radio program can do as well, calling attention to this issue and just informing people that inequality is growing, and if we want to do something about it, we should start thinking seriously about it.
Thank you, Martin Gillens, Pat Flavin, Tom Hayes. Appreciate you sharing your research with us and joining us. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Martin Gillens is professor of politics at Princeton University and the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and Why Americans Hate Welfare, Race, Media, and the Politics of Anti-Poverty Policy. Thomas Hayes is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Connecticut. His publications include Responsiveness in an Era of Inequality, The Case of the U.S. Senate. Patrick Flavin is a professor of political science at Baylor University. His publications include Income Inequality and Policy Representation in the American States. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produce this show each week. And to Sud Dongre and iConnect, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @armudian. See you next week.